headlines. Iran's foreign minister is on an official visit to China. He says strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks with Chinese officials. Fresh revelations emerge about parties held at the British Prime Minister's office during last year's COVID lockdown amid calls for Boris Johnson's resignation. North Korea test fires more ballistic missiles hours after it warned of strong reaction in case of new U.S. sanctions. Iran's foreign minister, now on an official visit to China, says strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks. With the officials there, Hossein Amir Abdullahian explained that the talks cover a range of issues, including international developments as well as political and economic issues. He made the comment upon his arrival in the Chinese city of Wuxi earlier on Friday. He says Iran and China have had good cooperation in recent months. He says the two sides have made good progress in different fields in line with their national interests. Amir Abdullahian has already met with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. This is News Review. Thank you for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his administration is putting efforts to remove anti-Iran sanctions high on the agenda. In a tweet, President Raisi said the efforts to neutralize the sanctions are not tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action known as the JCPOA. He said despite the existing sanctions, Iran is selling oil. Raisi said the sales have now increased to the level that no worries are left and revenues are being returned to the country. In separate remarks on Friday, President Raisi said sanctions and threats cannot hinder Iran's progress. He cited the country's military development, saying they have been achieved despite severe restrictions on this sector. Now, as the eighth round of talks goes on in Vienna to revive the JCPOA, the United States, which is indirectly taking part in the negotiation, says there are only a few weeks left to save the accord. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. is ready to look at other options and steps if the negotiations fail. The talks taking place between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA began in April of last year. The U.S. is not a party to the deal because it withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its JCPOA commitments a year later. Tehran says all those sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it will not leave the deal again. Joining us to discuss those issues in this news review will be Homa Lezgi. She's our correspondent in Vienna, as well as Sayed Abdullah Hosseini. He's a political analyst who joins us via Skype out of Tehran. It's good to have you both on the program. I'm going to begin, I guess, with Homa to fill us in regarding the latest information that is going on in Vienna. Homa?
Yes, Arash, as you say, the eighth round of the talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA is still ongoing. In about half an hour, maybe from now, we're going to have another meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Bagheri Kani, and the EU coordinator, Enrica Mora. Later, Mr. Bagheri will again meet representatives of the three European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany. And yesterday, he had a meeting with the Russian delegation. At the same time, expert-level talks are continuing, and we're hearing from sources close to the Iranian team that the expert-level talks have been focusing on implementation or sequencing. So what steps need to be taken, when, by which side? We know that the working groups have been working on various issues. One is the removal of U.S. sanctions. One is Iran's return to its nuclear commitments, and others focusing on verification and guarantees, the points you just mentioned in the news story. Also, the Russian ambassador, Mr. Ulyanov, when he was asked on Twitter whether there would be any break in this current round, he responded by saying that nobody as of yet has asked for such a break, and they're all focused on the, quote, the difficult talks moving ahead, and they want to make this happen. happen. Of course, you said there that the U.S. Has said that they want to make this restoration take place in a matter of weeks. They have been quite adamant on this issue of timing, both Europeans and the Americans and the EU coordinator themselves. They all have been saying that time is of the essence. Iran saying that it doesn't want to abide by any deadline. I don't think any of the participants want to do that, but they do want to make it happen as soon as possible if they can make this the final round. But of course, what we're hearing is that there are still a lot of technical, legal, and political matters that need further discussions, that need time. Behind the scenes, we're hearing that they still need more time to be able to find ways to give the verification that Iran needs, to get the guarantees that Iran needs in a way that would be acceptable for both parties, both the Americans and the Iranians. Arash.
All right. Next question goes to Sayed Abdullah Hosseini. And of course, I'm going to be asking you a question about the recent remarks made by Iran's president, where he has said that the issue of sanctions will not affect and the Iranian revenue making, that we are selling oil the way we want to. He's basically saying that there are no worries with or without the JCPOA. Your comments on that, sir?
Well, that is the difference between the new Iranian government and the previous one, where the previous government has been investing on the removal of sanction and the agreement with the West, the 5+1, when the American later on retreated from the agreement. And the new government has actually realized that they are facing governments which they have not delivered what they have promised before, and they have come and they have signed an agreement, and later on one way they have just left the whole agreement, and then later on they want to now come with imposing new questions and this and that. And that is something, the lesson which the new government has taken from the previous behavior of the West, the European plus the American, where they have signed agreement with Iran, is not to trust. That's one. Secondly, not to put all of your eggs in one basket, and also not to allow the sanction and also this agreement to actually dominate their economical decision inside the country. While the Iranian government has got also an experience with the last 40 years of sanction, if there was no sanction, the development which has been done in the last 4 decades actually have not been possible. And they also have got the experience of a country like South Africa. If today we have South Africa as a developing country, as a country which is very advanced technologically and from all aspects of view, the most important country in the whole Africa, is because of the apartheid sanction. In the time of apartheid, the apartheid regime was sanctioned by the whole world. So the apartheid government in that time, they have realized that they cannot lean on the international communities, so they have decided to develop their own countries, and whatever South Africa today have is because of those sanctions.
Yes, point taken.
So Iranian can take the same experience from South Africa, and through the sanction, actually, they can change it to an opportunity and develop their country.
Sure.
That's what the EC is doing, yes.
Sure. Homa, of course, let's just go back to the part where we spoke about the remarks made by Secretary of State Blinken, saying that there's going to be a few weeks between now and the possible agreement, and time is of essence, like you mentioned. You know, I'm pretty sure that you're quite familiar with the atmosphere of the talks. Making remarks like that, to what extent would you say, stir some kind of controversy among the delegation? Or, you know, what kind of impact do you think that will have to your experience?
Yes, so the Western side have been saying since the beginning of these talks that they want this to happen quickly. They have been, it's been becoming a refrain, actually, this issue of time and the time pressure, and that they want this to happen quickly. The Americans have been saying, because Iran is making advances in its nuclear program, if we make this drag on any longer, then it will not make any more sense. We know there are sunset clauses, for instance, in the text of the JCPOA when it comes to Iran's nuclear commitments. At the same time, what sources or political commentators are telling me is that the Iranians have already endured the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration. They believe that because Iran, as your guest was saying there, has this experience with sanctions, it doesn't have anything to lose. If these talks fail, Iran will continue to do what it did under the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration. Even they say if there is a snapback of the UN sanctions, it will not practically change a lot for the lives of the Iranians who are under pressure because of these sanctions. What they are saying is that the alternatives don't look very good for the Americans, because if the talks fail, what will be the alternatives for the Americans? More sanctions, a snapback of the UN sanctions, the threats of military action? Are these things that the US administration or their allies can afford or can support? This is why we're hearing maybe this sentiment from the Americans, and at the same time, this position from the Iranian side that they want an agreement that they can rely on for the foreseeable future.
Sure. And that question actually goes to Syed Abdullah Hosseini as well. If you can be brief with that, sir. What kind of impact do you think comments like that made by Secretary of State Blinken will have on the overall health of these talks?
Well, they have been always talking unhealthy discussions from day one. In fact, they are the cause of the delay. They are the cause of just coming out of the deal, neglecting the whole commitment that they had. From the day that Iran has signed, actually, this agreement, they have not benefited from the agreement. And that's why Iran looks at this as something which, if they cannot benefit out of it, it's better not to have it. So based on that, things which are coming out of the United States voice, I think it's unhealthy from both international communities and Iranian, what you call public opinion. But they are trying to do this to put pressure on Iran, while this pressure, I think they in the last 40 years, they have actually tested Iran's capability of holding the pressures and coping with the conditions and the situation. And they are testing a tested nation over and over again and again. And that's something which they have to come to their senses, that if pressure was effective, it was going to be effective in the last 40 years.
Thank you very much. That's Syed Abdullah Hosseini, political analyst out of Tehran, with those comments. And our good correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lezgi, in evidently very windy conditions there. Thank you very, very much, both of you, and thanks for your time. And, of course, thank you for remaining with us. Another blow to Boris Johnson's shaky premiership. Fresh reports say staff at the British Prime Minister's office partied on the eve of the socially distanced funeral of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. The UK-based Daily Telegraph says number 10 staff gathered on April the 16th of last year for two separate leaving events. One was for James Slack, the Prime Minister's departing Director of Communications, another one for a personal photographer of Johnson. The events took place the day before Prince Philip was laid to rest. That time, social gatherings were banned across the UK as part of COVID restrictions. Johnson himself was absent at those parties, but he is already facing calls to resign over several more parties held at Downing Street during lockdowns. Critics, including those from Labour, say Johnson is unfit to head the government and cannot be trusted. Downing Street parties entering new dimensions, perhaps, and that's what Amina Taylor, our correspondent, who joins us via Skype out of London, can tell us more about. Amina.
Oh, unfortunately, it seems that Sue Gray, the civil servant who is tasked with actually getting to the bottom of these events, is just finding herself with a creaking inbox. Not only did we find out about the party back in December, Then we found out more information about this damning Downing Street garden party, the Bring Your Own Booze event, and now we're hearing this. Now, let's be real about Johnson's political future here. Not only is it hanging by a thread, he's becoming toxic to even his own supporters, who know when you add the public's mood shifting on this and the betrayal people feel about following the rules that your own government sets, but you're finding out behind the scenes they're doing the opposite. You put that in now with the hawks who are circling, who perhaps never thought Johnson was up for the task, but felt maybe he was the only man for the Brexit job at that time. Well, times are changing, and this Prime Minister is becoming, quite frankly, a liability to the Conservatives.
Many, many thanks. That's Amina Taylor, our correspondent in London, filling us in on that situation. Amina, have a good Friday noon. South Korea and Japan say the North has conducted a new weapons test, firing projectiles eastward. The two countries say North Korea used two short-range ballistic missiles in the latest test. Pyongyang has already carried out two tests of what it called hypersonic missiles in the past week. Following that, the U.S. imposed sanctions on five people linked to North Korea's ballistic weapons program. The sanctions are the first by U.S. President Joe Biden's administration. North Korea says the measure is a provocation, and the U.S. is intentionally escalating the situation. Pyongyang says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Muslims respect for Jesus Christ no less than that of Christians. December 27, 2000. Undoubtedly, Muslims' respect for Jesus Christ is no less than that of faithful Christians for him. This great divine prophet always made efforts during his lifetime to fight oppression, transgression, corruption, and those who tried to dominate nations by relying on their wealth and power and cause them to suffer, both in this world and the hereafter. The sufferings which this great prophet endured since his childhood, God appointed him to his prophetic mission during his childhood, were all aimed at achieving these goals. Today, many of those who claim to follow the teachings of Jesus Christ are treading a path other than the one set by Jesus Christ. Jesus led humans to worshiping God and opposing pharaohs and transgressions. Today, there are people who claim to be the followers of that great prophet, but have taken the place of pharaohs and taghuts, whom Jesus Christ used to oppose during his time.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Religious minorities supporting the Islamic Republic, a source of honor for it. July the 9th, 2000. Thankfully, the followers of many different faiths live together peacefully in the Islamic Republic. Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians live alongside Muslims in the Islamic Republic. They cooperate with the Islamic Republic and play a role in the country. Of course, they shoulder certain duties. The Islamic Republic also shoulders certain duties towards them as Iranian citizens, which it fulfills. The Islamic Republic has no complaints against its citizens who are among the religious minorities of the country. When the enemies launch propaganda against the Islamic Republic in a sly manner, Jewish citizens publish statements. In other cases, Armenians or other religious minorities issued statements and expressed their support for the Islamic Republic. This is a source of honor for the Islamic Republic. The Renaissance paradise turned into an inferno. May the 9th, 2015. When the Westerners during the Renaissance period in Europe separated religion from science and politics, they intended to build a paradise on earth similar to one promised to mankind by religions. That paradise is now turned into an inferno. This is something even admitted by the Westerners themselves. It is true that the religion that European intellectuals in the Renaissance period opposed was not a true religion but a body of superstitions. It was totally against scientific advances and discoveries. This is why Galileo was sentenced to death for his scientific views, and other scientists were also tortured and even died of torture for their scientific discoveries. It was a distorted version of Christianity, not real Christianity. Therefore, there was nothing wrong with parting with this kind of religion in that period.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Midstream.
The number of recent attacks against U.S. occupation forces and their deployment sites in Syria and Iraq has increased significantly in an actual translation of the concept of resistance against the American occupation, a concept which Damascus announced its support for on many occasions and which the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, reiterated in his last speech on the occasion of the martyrdom of the two leaders, Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Over the past 2 weeks, the locations of U.S. forces have been the aim of frequent operations, as several bases have been targeted with rocket-propelled grenades and drones, including Conoco, Al-Umar, and At-Tanf. These areas mainly constitute incubators for terrorist factions headed by Daesh, which Damascus accuses Washington of supporting to launch attacks on Syrian army positions in the Syrian desert known as Badia. The large extension and geographical spacing of the targeted sites indicates the extent of the spread of the resistance forces, which carry out their operations in a flash to avoid slipping into a direct confrontation. The continuous attacks on U.S. bases, a number of which are located in areas far from residential areas, makes it impossible to monitor them accurately, especially in light of complete Western media blackout and the security and military cordon that surrounds these bases. At a time when other attacks on sites close to residential areas or large attacks that reverberate to distant places reveal the continuity and diversity of the attacks. In the meantime, while Uncle Sam has been constantly denying that any of his sites have been targeted, claiming the sounds of explosions heard in the area surrounding these bases are military drills. During the past week, the so-called International Coalition executed several operations targeting what it deemed to be missile launch sites. The escalation of the resistance attacks in Syria is accompanied by an increase in the movement of American forces on the ground and the return of American political activity to the Syrian arena after a period of stagnation and uncertainty, which was also paralleled by the return of Daesh activity, which Washington uses as a pretext for its continued presence in Syria. It was noticeable in the attacks launched by the resistance forces, in addition to the wide geographical area they now cover, their focus mainly on consistency, which aims to ensure instability on the one hand and increase pressure on the American forces, making their stay in Syria exhausting and detrimental. Such a strategy may constitute a decisive factor in prompting the U.S. to withdraw, even if it takes more time to get there, simply because relying on constant attacks means waging a war of attrition in a situation radically different from the previous years, during which Washington was immune and far from being targeted. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Our soldiers are still vulnerable, and we must take this threat seriously. With these words, the Pentagon summarized the situation in the areas of deployment of U.S. occupation forces in Syria and Iraq at a time when Washington began carrying out attacks on what it said were missile launch sites at its bases. It is apparent through the acceleration of the attacks and the expansion of their targeting that the resistance forces have begun a new phase of their operations aimed at increasing the level of risk for the Americans in the event they decide to stay in Syria after they decided to resume their military and political activity there. It is true that this path is not new, but recent developments indicate that there is vigorous effort being directed against the Americans, which during the past year amounted to more than 10 in Hasake and Deir ez-Zor, while it seems that it will exceed this number in less than a month this year, if it actually continues at this new pace. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is retired Syrian Army General and political analyst Mr. Mohammed Abbas. Well, Mr. Mohammed, thank you for being with us now. Coinciding with the second anniversary of the assassination of the dual leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Deputy of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we have what is now known as the Popular Resistance renewing its targeting of U.S. occupation bases in Syria, forcing the Americans to withdraw from a 10th phase into Jordan in fear of being targeted. How do you assess such an achievement?
Thank you very much. Actually, when we talk about Soleimani, military Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we should remember that despite their militarism, they will be able to continue their business in the theater of war. Actually, through the continuation of the popular resistance and the front confront the occupation targeting America bases, preventing them from any stability in Syria and Iraq, exposing the state of fear experienced by American forces in Syria and Iraq, and forcing them to temporarily maneuver part of their forces towards Jordan, which is evidence of the American inability to confront the resistance forces. Military American leaders predict that the attacks against their occupied forces are going to be increased much more. That is why America is going to change its troops, instead of the American nationality soldier, changed it by the American proxy armies, which consists of ISIS and Al Qaeda and Nusra and other troops, what called the Islamic groups. Indeed, they are the Arab version of Blackwater, the American security company. That is how USA avoids, loses among the, there's no soldiers loses from the American nationality, but only you can say the loss of the casualties, more all casualties nowadays are being in the proxy armies. From what called the American proxy armies, actually.
The resistance fighters not only targeted the U.S. occupation bases of Conoco and Al-Shaddadi on New Year's Eve with several mortar and rocket-propelled grenades, but they did it again by targeting the largest American base in Al-Umar oil field in Syria. Do you expect an increase in anti-American operations in Iraq, as is in Syria, or was that latest round only linked maybe to the second anniversary of the martyrdom of the two leaders?
Thank you. Certainly, the memory of the mercenaries Soleimani and al-Muhandis is so precious to the Syrian and Iraqi people, but the military operations against the occupation forces are going to be continued against the American occupation in many shapes, not only one by targeting using the rockets or artillery, but there are other types in the targeting in the oil fields, targeting in the military bases, targeting on the side roads, using mines, snipers, using many types of the of obstacles against that American forces. But I'd like to tell you something, maybe or this note, that American soldiers who has nationality soldiers, American nationality soldiers, are using helicopters to move from point to other. But the proxy armies, soldiers or warriors, the American proxy warriors used to use the vehicles and land transportation. Why? To avoid the bombsite explosions or other things. By the way, Syrian and Iraqi citizens will not allow the American forces to continue their practices on our land. They are going to go on for in their resistances. But I'd like to say that despite the resistance is still growing, but the American analysts predict a complex, coordinated, and deliberated attacks and sophisticated strikes. Resistance is becoming more accurate, more effective, and a spate of escalation in attacks are happening daily. They are using bomb sites, as I said, and rose mines and other weapons. You can use a stone, you can use a stick, you can use the situation of our Syrian people in many villages and many towns who prevent Americans from passing during the streets or the village. It is a sign or a sign to see or to say that you are we will not allow Americans to stay in our land.
Well, Mr. Muhammad, it is evident that the resistance factions have pushed the Americans to evacuate Al-10th base, as we said at the beginning of the show. But this act actually shows how the Americans are unable to impose any new battlefield equations here. But it gives me a bit of a concern here. There is Syrian concern, general concern, that the U.S. might retaliate militarily to attempt to protect its occupation forces in Syria. How do you think that would be possible?
Of course, Syrian people is supporting the, first of all, Syrian people are supporting the public resistance movement, which poses high combat capabilities that emerged through this using artillery, mortars, rocket artillery, and other means, with the ability to make serious strategic and high precision of using drones in injury. The American concern about the increase of in operation is clear, and the base temporary evacuation is the evidence of that. Emphasizing that the Americans are retaliating Syrian forces. They are retaliating Syrian forces, actually, daily. Daily, not we are waiting them, but they use it daily to retaliate from Syria. By how? By employing proxy armies or by itself through the exchanging rules between American and Turkish and Israeli forces by itself or by the proxy warriors. How we can explain, how you can understand Israeli targeting or strikes, continuous strikes against Syria and the Turkish occupied wide areas in southern of Syria, and the what's about the Syrian defense, what is the Syrian defense forces, SDF. It is another type of ISIS. Mm-hmm. What called SDF is another type of ISIS, another type of proxy American armies. So I'd like to remember or to say that Americans troops, American jet bombed Syrian forces in Atalda on 2016, as I think.
Yes, killing
by
more than 100 Syrian Arab Army soldiers. We remember that very well, and we will never forget that, actually, Mr. Muhammad. I want to thank you very much. Sadly, that's all the time that we have, but I promise that we will have you again to talk more about how the Syrian population is refusing to have occupation, any kind of occupation, on its land. I want to thank you very much, Syrian Army General, retired Syrian Army General and political analyst, Mr. Muhammad Abbas Muhammad, for joining us. Thank you for your time. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Palestinians are facing Israeli bullets on a daily basis in the West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Palestinian Bakir Hashash, 21 years old, was killed by the Israeli occupation in the occupied West Bank early on Thursday as the occupation entered an area east of the northern city of Nablus to make administrative arrests. Meanwhile, 24 Palestinians were wounded by Israeli bullets during clashes that took place in several areas across the occupied West Bank, trying to condemn the illegal settlements. The center of Hebron has been witnessing almost weekly activities rejecting the occupation and settlement building, which the occupation forces confront by firing live and rubber bullets and tear gas canisters. The occupation forces continue their attacks against the Palestinians after launching a massive campaign of raids in the West Bank, especially in Bethlehem, Halhul, and Jenin. Palestinians face Israeli bullets in the occupied West Bank in this following report.
Israeli occupation forces continue to assault Palestinians in various cities and villages of the occupied West Bank. The Israeli operation saw the occupation launch a large-scale raid campaign in the occupied West Bank, especially in Nablus, Beit Lahem, Halhul, and Jenin, leading to the death of 21-year-old Bakir Hashash and wounding scores others. Palestinian natives responded to the attacks by retaliating with rocks against the illegal colonial settlers, especially near the town of Tekoa, southeast of Bethlehem. Young Palestinian youth also resorted to targeting a settler bus near Halhul, north of Hebron, with Molotov cocktails to pressure Israeli forces out of their towns. Palestinian media also stated that occupation forces deployed heavily in the Bir Ayyub neighborhood, the entrance to Ain al-Lawza and Al-Ain Street in the town of Silwan, adding that the forces set up roadblocks, closed the streets of Bir Ayyub, attacked the neighborhood with multiple grenades, and arrested two young men, Mundir Ruwaidi and Ihab Abu Sneina. As if the Israeli aggression was not enough, the Palestinian Authority's security apparatuses took matters into their own hands, arresting the son of prisoner Zakaria al-Zubaydi, Muhammad al-Zubaydi, along with some of his companions. However, due to the intensity of the situation, the Palestinian Authority was pressured to release Muhammad al-Zubaydi at Saturday dawn, just hours after detaining him in Jenin-occupied West Bank. Muhammad Zubaydi, Ayham Al-Saadi, and Aws Al-Shalabi were released following intense calls to simmer down the situation in the Jenin refugee camp. Public resentment is on the rise against the Palestinian National Security Services in the Jenin camp, with the camp's residents opening fire against the district headquarters, infuriated by the continuous Palestinian Authority crackdown on residents of the camp, especially after a video went viral showing the Palestinian National Security Services inhumanely assaulting and arresting Muhammad Zubaydi in Jenin. The use of violence, severe beating, and human rights violations when done by the Zionist entity are clear acts of occupation against native Palestinians. However, when done by the Palestinian Authority are nothing but shameful, reoccurring phenomena in Palestine. Not so long ago, activist Nizar Banat was killed due to the use of violence and severe trauma. The same could have happened to Muhammad Zubaydi if the batons had hit the young man in the head. This violence only reflects the security apparatus's incompetence, weakness, divergence from the values of Palestinians, and lack of respect for their dignity. This physical violence will only result in counter-violence and hatred, yet sadly the lack of accountability will simply exacerbate such a crackdown.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Ramallah is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zeit University and political analyst. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Saad. Dr. Saad, 22-year-old Palestinian Bakir Muhammad Musa Hashash was shot in the head after the Israeli occupation forces entered Blata refugee camp east of Nablus city to make administrative arrests late last week. Bakir is not the first nor the last to be martyred at the hands of the Zionist occupation forces, but it seems that fire is raging in the West Bank, this time much different than any other time before. Why do you think that?
Well, it's quite sure for us that the Israeli had ended the last year by killing Hashash, but not that to stop anyway. By the beginning of this year also, the escalation is so high in the Israeli troops against the occupation troops and the settlers against the Palestinians. It's quite clear that there is a kind of an escalation in the last year and all over last year, 2021. Till today, it's quite obvious that the settlers are trying to gain time as much as they could, since the American administration are not interested so far in the Middle East issue, and they are focusing more on the Iranian issue, on Russia and on China, rather than the Middle East. And I think that the Israeli and the settlers particularly, and especially the government, because this government, the Israeli government, is a settler government, are trying to gain the time and try to make facts on the ground that would be very hard to reverse. Because of that, they are trying to grab as much land as they could. They are trying to escalate the confiscation of land, building settlements, and enlarging existing settlements. All that was in a kind of a campaign against the Palestinians in the last year.
Well, that sums up the fear of the Zionist entity from what might actually come out of the West Bank. Despite the fact that the West Bank may have been the last Palestinian region to join the massive popular uprising against the Sheikh Jarrah evictions and then the Saif al-Quds operations back in May, but today it remains the only area where resistance protests continue to flare up against the Israeli occupation and its illegal settlement building. How do you assess these developments in light of an actual possible Israeli incursion into the West Bank?
Well, I would tell you that the West Bank, especially in the last week, there was, you know, a kind of a mini intifada, I would call it. It was all over the West Bank. It was in Beit Umar and in Susia, in Yatta, both in Hebron. It was in Kufr Qaddoum, in Qalqilia. It was in Tkur, in Beit Lahem. It was in Jabal Sabih, in Nablus, and in Sebastian Nakura, also near the settlement called Shabi Shamron on the road between Nablus and Jenin. It was all over the West Bank. There were a kind of a clashes with the settlers and clashes with the Israeli army, and the Palestinians were trying even to cut the roads for the settlers, as far as the settlers are doing so every when and while. So the Palestinians now, they are taking the decision to cut the roads for the settlers. However, there is a kind of a popular resistance among the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank. But we can say that this is not enough. And this is, let me say, in a minimal situation. And we need to escalate the popular resistance and all other kind of resistance, not only the popular.
Well, 100%, I definitely agree with what you're saying. But sadly, the Palestinian National Security Services are not giving the West Bank any slack either. I mean, the continuous crackdown against Palestinian activists is on the rise, like we just saw last week with Mohammed al-Zubaydi, son of one of the Freedom Tunnel heroes, Zakaria al-Zubaydi, being beaten up and arrested like he was a thug, with video documenting this horrific assault. Although he was released later on Saturday because of all the continuous pressure, it's still physical violence that will only result in counter-violence. Why is the Palestinian Authority adamant on going down the road of violence against its own people?
Yeah, we are getting now into totally another area here, let me say, where when we talk about the Palestinian resistance, we mean that all kind of resistance for the Palestinian people should be allowed, and Palestinians have the right to resist the occupation in any way they find it appropriate. That was according to the 1982 resolution in the United Nations. Mm-hmm. Now, the Palestinian Authority, and particularly President Mahmoud Abbas, he believed from the very beginning in a non-violence line of resistance. Because of that, the orders for the security forces, in Palestinian security forces, is to stop any kind of violence and to maintain only popular, as they call it, peaceful resistance to the occupation. And at the same time, they are continuing with the cooperation with the Israelis, and especially in the security coordination, which also came as a hard grab against the Palestinian resistors who are trying, you know, to do sometimes some operations. We believe, as Palestinians, that most of the Palestinians believe that the Israeli occupation is an act of violence, as I would put it, as exactly Franz Fanon had put it. Any occupation is an act of violence, and we need to react in also an, a violence way. That's the only way to resist this occupation. Yes, I believe in the popular resistance and the both intifadas, the first one and the second one. It started as a popular resistance by the Palestinian people, but at the same time, we do need all kind of other sorts of resistance to exist, and the Palestinian Authority is committing a huge mistake by preventing Palestinians from practicing their own resistance. Now, that would come to an end, which would, might be, you know, very bad, especially that the Israeli occupation and settlers are continuing on a daily basis in, you know, attacking the Palestinians and grabbing the land. And what is the answer by the Palestinian Authority? It's just, you know, trying to calm down the situation and try to say, yeah, we will resist by the popular resistance. This is not enough, and we believe that sooner or later, and what happened yesterday or the few days ago, last Friday, on Jenin, as the incident that you mentioned, that the Palestinian resistors, they started even shooting at the Al-Muqata'a, at the headquarters, the Palestinian headquarters of the security forces in Jenin, and today everyone was commenting on that, is showing that if the Palestinian Authority is continuing with this kind of line in not attacking the Israeli troops and allowing the settlers in doing so without any kind of resistance, definitely the Palestinians are going to go further mm-hmm. in their resistance.
Definitely. When they see that there is no real resistance on the ground, they will make their own way to resist. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zeit University and political analyst, for joining us to talk about the latest very risky situation in the West Bank, with all hopes and support for the Palestinian people, for academics like you, and for the youth like those who are resisting this Zionist aggression. I want to thank you very much. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. Please stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream. Salam.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And my dear guest speakers in the studio, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. In this series of programs, Viewpoint, or the Movie Critique Program, we are mainly focusing on the religious concepts rather than the artistic features typical of so-called critical programs about arts and artistic characteristics of the movies. So our main purpose is to address those features and themes which are related about religion and God and whatsoever that goes with that territory. Well, today we decided to work on another movie with the theme of miracle, just like the last Christian movie. It's called The Girl Who Believes in Miracles. This is a 2021 American Christian drama film directed and produced by Richard Coro. All right. And the whole story is about a young girl who heals a bird simply through prayer, and becomes a national celebrity when more miracles are attributed to her, while dying of an inoperable brain tumor. Well, before me asking you questions and the critique of the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles, let's take a listen to a short part of the trailer or part of the movie.
Grandpa, when I found the bird, I prayed.
God, you made this poor little guy, so maybe you could help him out.
His heart isn't beating, Sarah, and he's dead.
Then I saw God standing on the other side of the lake.
I always thought that you were kind of special.
You see him?
Who?
God.
You saw God and then brought a dead bird back to life.
No, I didn't. God did.
Where'd you get this?
I drew it when I came home tonight.
You drew this?
Yeah.
just sounds like she has a healthy imagination to me.
She would never outright lie. My cat died last week. I was wondering if you could stop by and bring him back to life.
Mom, it really was God.
Sir, do you think you can help me walk again?
I don't know.
Could you say a prayer for me?
So, tell me what this medical emergency is all about.
I moved my toes this morning.
I can't explain what happened in there. Severed nerves and spinal cord can't regenerate.
Mom?
Oh, my baby.
Oh, I thought he was never supposed to walk again.
He wasn't.
It was Sarah.
You just listened to a part of the movie The Girl Who Believes in Miracles. This is a very new American movie, a Christian drama film directed and produced by Richard Quarle. In this program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. Brother Hussein, how did you find this movie? Was it something that you liked, or it was a boring movie for you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I feel like boring is an understatement. The story was kind of engaging. It was a classic church movie. Nothing too interesting. The title is literally self-explanatory. The Girl Who Believes in Miracles. And that's exactly what happens.
Yes.
It's like about a girl who develops an extraordinary or like magic-like ability to where she prays to God for different things to happen, and God accepts her prayers almost instantly.
Yes.
With the bird, mm-hmm. How did that happen?
I see.
The question I have is, if this was ever possible, what would the ethical and moral grounds be? What I mean is, what type of responsibility would such a person have in that particular situation?
I see. Sayyid Abdullah, any comments?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it's not a moral. I mean, the story to begin with, the story is a fictional story, right?
Yes.
It's based on a book called Mustard Seed. And like Brother Hassan said, it's just a Christian
theme. Yeah.
Theme. But it's, where a girl can bring things back to life. I think the concept is, we do have people who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala chooses to favor them or give them the blessings. They are able to cure. We have, especially us as Shia, we have so many ulama who had this capacity to heal. Yes. Like they touch you.
Karama.
So we don't call it a miracle, because if we discuss that term, we can dive into it. Allah gives them this blessing that they can heal people and they can cure people. But to bring them to life, that's
it's
obviously...
not even such a big deal for them. They can do lots of other bigger things.
It's not, yeah. That's
the, no, but the ethical and moral thing is that what responsibility would that person have in terms of...
Allah would never
what if
give...
you cure someone and then they go and do something bad?
No. Right. A curing is a different issue. I mean,
yes.
Because I cure you, it doesn't mean I will be responsible for your sin. You're a free person. You have a free will. You can do whatever you want to do. Doesn't mean I am not, I cannot, I should not help you.
Of course,
you
but
to,
if it wasn't for you, then I wouldn't, I would still have cancer.
No, if it wasn't for Allah creating us, I wouldn't sin. So I could blame Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for all my sins.
Well,
he made
me. That's Allah.
No,
you can compare
it's
me
the
to
same
Allah.
Concept. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, at the end of the day, He takes me and you by the ear based on the fact that we have free will to commit. Because, for example, a lot of people come to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and to the Imams for a cure, and the Imams cured them. And these people were, to begin with, sinful people.
Yes.
They weren't even believers. Some of them were even mushrikeen, but they got cured by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. And they continued their kufr. So we can hold the Prophet accountable, we can hold the Imams accountable. No. So him curing is one thing, you committing an action is another thing. So you can't really blame them for your actions.
Well,
oh, because if you want me, if I was crippled, disabled, then
addressed.
I wouldn't be here.
Let's take a short break and we'll listen to a part of the movie, The Girl Who Believes in Miracles, a new movie, and we'll be back with more criticism.
It is perfectly typical for most people to have a strong faith in their families, relying on them for love and support. These are people we've grown up with, who've nurtured us, and who hopefully have been real cheerleaders for us. But let's look at another parable that talks about a different kind of faith. And here's what it says. The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, and which indeed is smaller than all seeds. But when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that birds come and lodge in its branches. And indeed, faith can become so strong that it can move a mountain.
Back to the program Viewpoint, a movie critique program on RIB English Radio. Well, relying on people like family for love and support versus having faith in God. Sayyid Abdullah, is it a kind of polytheism?
It depends, because we have a saying, we have a hadith, actually not a saying, it says shirk, polytheism. It's like a black ant on a black stone, on a black black, what was that, the word?
Yes, it was soft, like stone, a, in like the dark an night. Ant talk.